Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, here, of course, with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Eli Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. So, Victor, you have a column out this week called Building the New Dark Age Mind, the broad themes of which are that there is an intellectual and perhaps in some sense a moral decline at work in the United States right now. And also that history isn't linear. That is, that no matter how successful a society has been in the past, there's still always the possibility for these kinds of declines. So let me read a passage from the opening paragraph. Quote, "There was more free speech and unimpeded expression in 5th century Athens than in Western Europe between 1934 to 1945 or in Eastern Europe during 1946 to 1989. Fine. I think we'd all assent to that proposition fairly quickly. Next sentence, Victor. An American could speak his mind more freely in 1970 than now," end quote. Now, Victor, you just know that there is some pearl-clutching 23-year-old blogger in a Brooklyn coffee shop right now hyperventilating over the fact that Victor Davis Hanson just drew a parallel between Europe under the boot of fascists and the contemporary United States. And now I want you to compound that horror by explaining to them why, in some ways, what's happening in the latter case is more insidious.
Well, let me just start by saying I was a student in 1971 at UC Santa Cruz, and the motif there, take feminism for example, were that women were confident, they were going to be outspoken. I used to be abused for opening the door for them. I came from a farm. I was taught by my parents to do that, and they were going to take. They were going to define their own sexuality in ways that were going to emulate the male, and that was what I understood from feminism was what they wanted. In other words, and it was sort of a revolutionary, in your face. We're equal. We can do whatever we want. We can say whatever we want. Pejorative words, the F word. Everything was open. It was open season. If you go to the campus today, we have a return of Victorianism that you cannot say certain things, or if you were a young male today and you were to engage in a mutually consensual sexual relationship, premarital, it would be very different than what the rules were in the 1970s. They would call it progress, but in terms of free expression, there's a different attitude about feminism than there used to be. And the same thing probably about race. People, I understand, were coming out of the civil rights movement, but there was the idea that integration, intermarriage, assimilation was going to be the goal. So if you had told somebody in 1970, we're going to have safe spaces, or we're going to have microaggression watches, and we're going to segregate people by dorm and segregate, that hadn't quite happened yet. And so in some ways, if you said today in the free speech at Cal State University somewhere and said, I believe in intermarriage, integration, assimilation is our goal, and I'm not being rhetorical now because, as you know, the UC system just came out under Napolitano, or it's a couple of years old, but there are guidelines that you're not supposed to say that America is a land of opportunity, or you're not supposed to talk about racially blind concepts. So just in the United States in this 45-year period, we've really regressed in terms of free speech, and that happens in history a lot. Happened under Woodrow Wilson during World War I, but at least it was a war.
How did that happen in higher education? I mean, you've got these college campuses brimming with these delicate porcelain creatures who can't brook the slightest intellectual provocation, whether it's real or imagined. How did we get to a place where these institutions, which ostensibly pride themselves on the fearless pursuit of truth, are now the homes of the safe spaces and the trigger warnings?
I think what happened is two things. One, it was personnel. We had what Roger Kimball wrote 20 years ago, tenured radicals, people I went to school with, and never in my right mind did I think they were going to be college presidents and deans, given what I knew about them. But they've taken over the university, and they don't feel that it's a disinterested learning experience anymore. They feel that the corporation, the country, religion, tradition, the family will all warp people during their lives and make them conservative. And they have only a brief 4 to 6 year period. And so they can be unfair and they can be biased and they can indoctrinate because they feel that society does it too. And they're just getting back at it. And that's the premise that they work under. And then the second is that I don't think we've realized that the university has really become completely, it was always detached, but now it's completely detached and unaccountable. And what I mean by that is that left-wing ideology has amassed some pretty horrible things. In the California, about 45% of the units are taught by discriminated against part-time faculty who do the same work as full-time professors and get very little money. And that's what most of the new positions are, by the way. And yet, because it's a left-wing enterprise, nobody believes that they treat their employees far worse than they do at Walmart. And then we talk about administrative bloat, but if you say that we need an assistant diversity czar or a special provost to the president for community relations, sort of like what Michelle Obama was before her husband became president, that's not considered administrative blight. That's not considered a grandee using the system. So we, and the same thing about free speech in class. If you want to say something about Mormons or Christians or white males, you can go ahead and say it. But under the cloak of being liberal, ostensibly in theory, in fact, it's been a very illiberal place, the university. And all this, the subtext of all I'm getting at is that what's been, this is very time consuming and it's very expensive. So when you see a student at Cal State Fresno, where I taught, or I've taught at Pepperdine or at Hillsdale, even the good schools, and you ask them, because they come out of high schools and even a good college can't rectify the damage, you say, what was Omaha Beach? What was Gettysburg? Who was Oliver Cromwell? What's the Ionic capital? Who was Zeus? They have no idea whatever you're talking about. There's no common body of knowledge that they've had because their curriculum has been therapeutic. And you look at their transcripts when they apply for jobs, and I get a lot of them that send it to me. I just count the number of classes that have the word studies. Leisure studies, environmental studies, ethnic studies, Asian studies, feminist studies, migrant worker studies. And that just tells me they're not learning how to reason. They're not learning facts. They're not losing history, biology, math. It's a whole generation that we've lost.
Another of the intellectual pathologies that you identify in this column, you write, quoting you again, a pre-Enlightenment age is not just the absence of uncomfortable free expression. It's also a sort of groupthink acceptance of a lie in place of the truth on grounds of social utility. Explain that.
Well, let's take Ferguson, for example, as a way of illustration. Hands up, don't shoot. People in Congress went through that. People in the NBA go through that. President Obama routinely evokes Ferguson. What does Ferguson mean? It means really that Michael Brown went into a liquor store, tried to rob it, and did rob it, and then walked under the influence down the wrong – right in the middle of a street until he was stopped by an officer whose gun he tried to lunge at, tried to take, and then he ran away. Then he turned around and charged, and he was shot. And that's not my view. That's the view of the Eric Holder Justice Department. Okay, that was the forensic and the eyewitness collaborative evidence. But so what do we do with that? We can't use the truth. So Michael Brown becomes, you know, sort of like the Rosenbergs or Rigoberta Menchu. If it wasn't true, it should have been true. And so we mouth this lie. And same thing with Mattress Girl. We know that that was a complete fraud. But it doesn't matter, you see, because it has social utility. It brings attention to racism or sexism. And the truth always is subservient. It's what Orwell spent the last part of his life warning us about. And the same thing with Stalin. You know, go into Poland and kill 7,000 Polish officers and say that Nazis did it. Well, the Nazis are capable of doing a lot worse than that, but that's not the issue. The issue is he could lie because it served a social purpose. And, you know, the FDR even told Polish radio stations in Chicago, don't air that argument that the Nazis did it. Just say that Stalin did it. Stalin didn't do it. Excuse me. And so we have this idea that in certain periods of groupthink, the facts on the ground don't matter. It's what the usefulness of the message is for social justice and egalitarianism.
Now, we're covering a lot of ground here, whether it's college campuses or identity politics, that our listeners might expect on a conversation about this topic. But there's something that comes as a bit of surprise for someone reading your piece, because another area that you point to as an example of what you call it 21st century know-nothingism is the drought in California. Explain how that fits into this framework.
Well, I'm sitting here in Fresno, and it was 105 yesterday. And yesterday I had two conversations, and one was about the water table with a neighbor, and the other was with a renter about the water table. And people have been pumping for 4 years. That's the only way they can not only survive in their rural residence to get water for their homes, but also to plant, and that never happens. Usually you get surface water. There is no surface water because, A, the population is now 40 million, not 20 like the last major drought. B, we've allowed 9 million acre feet to go out to the sea in a crazy thought experiment about how to reintroduce salmon in the 19th century landscape that no longer exists in the San Joaquin watershed and to save the Delta smelt. And then C, we didn't follow our grandfather's warning that when you get up to 30, 40, 50, 60 million, you have to complete the tertiary phase of the California Water Project, which was about 20 million acre feet. And we didn't do that. And instead, we thought, you know what? That's unnatural. We don't need to do that. We have Apple. We have Google. We have Yahoo. We're sophisticated postmodern. We're not vulnerable to the pre-modern ideas of drought. So as one person told me at Stanford last week, look at the 280 reservoir. It's full. We have plenty of water. We have our own watershed. And I said, you idiot, don't you realize that that water comes all the way from Hetch Hetchy, which is about dry? And once that goes dry, your aquifer doesn't really exist in Silicon Valley. It only provides 20% of your water. And San Joaquin Valley water projects in Northern California water projects provide the other 40, and they're going to be dry. So what we should have been doing is, it's a long way of saying we should have been in year two building the Sites Reservoir, the Los Banos Grandes Reservoir, the Temperance Flat Reservoir, and then looked at the big canceled projects like raising Shasta Dam. And we would have had, by now, we could have done it in 2 or 3 years. We could have had, you know, for the next rain that happens, we would have some water storage for the next drought, but we're not going to do that. And we're going to be into a cataclysmic event if it doesn't rain this winter.
Victor, all these intellectual ticks that you're identifying across all of these topics, what is it in your judgment that makes a society susceptible to these pathologies? America's been doing a decent business now for nearly a quarter of a millennium. If we're just now undergoing the kind of atrophy of character from which it's hard to return, what's changed? Why can't we resist this now?
Well, I go back to my favorite piece of classical literature, Petronius's Satyricon, a novel that was written about 65 AD. And everything that we're experiencing was in that novel, from transgenderism to deprecation of the military to a vast elite overindulgence. And the message from Petronius, as well as Catullus and other writers, was a word they called luxus. It's not quite luxury, it's more as license. And the idea is that when societies reach a level of affluence and leisure, then the human appetites warp and change. So we're at a situation now where if you're not working because of state support and high tech, you can have a pretty good existence. And if you are working, even though Americans that are working work pretty hard, there are things that you can do, whether it's, you know, look at your iPhone and find out what the weather is in Nigeria, or you know, have a picture phone, a face phone call with somebody in Brazil that we've never imagined. And what this has done is it's deluded people into thinking, wow, I'm so smart now. My society is so neat. Oh, my culture is so high tech. I'm sort of immune from all of the old things. I don't have to work like my grandfathers did. I don't have to go to church. I don't have to meet people in the community. I don't have to follow the laws. I can be an individual. I don't have to get a vaccination. I don't have any history of how the great struggle in California to get people vaccinated. I don't have to vaccinate my dog. I don't have to clean the bathroom when I use it. I can do anything I want because I'm so wealthy and I'm so privileged. I'm so leisured. And they don't understand that nature comes and says, you know what? We don't care who you are. There's still things like droughts. There's still things like epidemics that come through a society. There's still things like people who are human predators. And that's what's happening. And that happened to Rome. It happened to Byzantium. It happened to almost every sophisticated society. The enemy's usually within. It's not at the gates.
So final question then, what are the prospects that we're able to pull out of the tailspin?
Well, I'm not optimistic because these are not self-correcting phenomena. Mm-hmm. Nobody, a generation doesn't say, you know what, I'm going to go back to traditional protocols about how I approach the community and my family and the government. There'll be pockets of it, and you see, already see what's happening. It's exactly what happens in history. People are self-segregating. So there's about half the population who are moving to red states or within their own blue states are saying, you know what, I'm not going to weigh in on transgendered issues at work. I'm not going to talk about abortion. I'm not going to talk about racial relations. I'm not going to talk about Barack Obama. I'm going to go to work. I'm going to come home. I'm going to have my gun in my closet. I'm just going to disassociate myself from popular culture. And it's sort of a what the Athenians called quietism, where people just sort of intellectually, physically, metaphysically drop out. And that's what's happened. We have a country now of people who either drop out by with their feet or psychologically they disconnect from popular culture. They don't go to the movies anymore. They don't believe in Hollywood. They don't watch a lot of TV anymore. They just say, you know, that I don't want to be part of that culture. And that's kind of dangerous because we're really getting to like 1850 where we have two countries that are absolutely incompatible.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. But join us again next week for the next installment of the Classicist podcast. And in the meantime, stop by hoover.org where you can read all of Professor Hansen's commentary. We'll see you back here soon. For Victor Davis Hansen and the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.